I started a blog. Nothing super public or interesting, just for myself and some friends because I like to write. The hate mail started right away. So did the feedback. People correcting my grammatical errors, telling me my arguments were weak, chipping away at my work. This was a small blog. I'm not a celebrity. And while I talked about politics, it wasn't even my main focus. This was just me talking. Talking was enough to bring out more hate than I was prepared to manage. Finally, there was a rape threat or two. I ultimately shut it down. And then I read Kate Mann's work about misogyny policing women who push back. And that's when I knew. I knew what had happened to me. Hi, I'm Zahn Valliens, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. I'm here today with my guest, the philosopher Kate Mann. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Son. It's great to be back.
I'm so glad to have you here. So, Kate is a friend of the show and has been on before. So, I'm not going to spend a ton of time introducing her, but suffice it to say, she's amazing, brilliant, and kind, and I love her. I'll put all of her information in the show notes, all of her books, and all of that. But the reason that I brought Kate on today is that I have been thinking a lot about what it means to be a public feminist, what it means to be a public woman, what it means to be a woman who succeeds at all in your chosen field, and how misogyny just chips away at it and chips away at it. And I started writing something about it, and I kept referencing Kate, and I thought, well, Kate and I should just talk about this on the podcast. So that's what we're doing.
I'm so glad to have this conversation because it's something that's rarely not on my mind in some form too. It is hot out there.
It's so dark. So I think that most people who follow your work or my work or any feminist or who really know like anything about like being a woman in the world, I think they know that like you get threats and that people are mean and awful. But they may not know the extent of it, and they may not know that like it's not just threats that are awful. So I thought maybe we could start by talking about like, what do our inboxes look like? Like, what are you hearing from people, and what am I hearing from people, and like, how does that affect you?
So I will say that my inbox looked very different in the age of Twitter, where I would just get a pretty steady stream of sometimes threatening, sometimes merely insulting, sometimes very patronizing, and sometimes very mansplainy kinds of emails, saying why I was wrong to be a feminist, why I was everything wrong with America today, why I was wrong in some particular view. So I've attracted a lot of hate for always having been a firmly trans inclusive feminist. And whenever I've written about race and racism in this country, I've also gotten a lot of pushback to the effect of being some kind of race traitor, which is often mixed in with various strands of anti-Semitism because I'm Jewish and people seem to know that, even though at the time, often that information wasn't particularly easy to find, not because I hide it, but because it's not been particularly relevant in my own work. How about you?
Yeah, so it's sort of similar. I probably like everybody have like paid to have my information removed from the internet because it's really scary. And like every time I'm in my garden and someone drives by and slows down to like look at my garden, I'm like, oh, is this it? Like, are they here to shoot me now? Because that's what it's come to mean to be a woman in the public eye. And like when I say like a woman in the public eye, like I want to clarify that like I don't mean celebrities or like well-known writers or influencers. Like, I mean any woman who has established any positive reputation. Like, if you're a successful lawyer, if you're a successful doctor, if you pretty much anywhere, if you attain some success, you're gonna end up with this kind of hate. So there's the incel bit, and I use incel as like a catch-all term for violent men. But then I've begun to see something new creep in that has really only started once I started my Substack. And you and I were talking about this a little bit before we started recording. the people with whom we have these parasocial relationships who feel like they know us and as a result feel a sense of ownership. And they will give you feedback that on its surface seems well-meaning, and maybe sometimes it is, but the net effect of getting so much of that feedback all day, every day, is that first, you can't respond to or acknowledge at all. And secondly, it's just this like avalanche of negativity and often very personal negativity of, I really think you need to work on this thing about your personality is like the tone.
It is really interesting, and it's a really distinctive double standard along the lines of gender. So, women get this. I think some other gender marginalized people get this, and men, by and large, don't. That if we're a public figure of any kind, there is a sense that people know us personally. And that goes beyond having a parasocial relationship with us. It's even if there is no parasocial relationship and no contact and really nothing there, people feel like there is this personal connection in virtue of which we owe them. We owe them certain kinds of time, certain kinds of explanation, certain kinds of personal attentiveness. I mean, I often get emails that I really doubt my male colleagues get, where people will say things like, "Hi, Kate, not Dr. Man or Professor Man." And that's fine, but I'm fine with people calling me Kate, but it's already sort of that distinctive sense that there's no need for formality, which I would kind of prefer to be the one to say that. And then the email will be this very personal request for advice or help understanding my theories, when they'll say something like, "Well, I haven't read your books, but I heard you once give an interview. Could you break down the distinction between sexism and misogyny for me? Because that sounded interesting and I'd like to hear more."
Oh
It's
my
like,
God.
well, I in a way would love to help, but I also get so many demands on my time. I am a committed teacher. I'm a full-time professor. I mentor a lot of people informally, and I'm happy to do so. If it's someone who I don't actually have any relationship with, I do try to respond, and I try to respond kindly because I do value that. But it's also exhausting, and it's this sense that I personally owe them time, explanation, and information that is very much out there. Like, you can just go look up my stuff and read it.
Yeah, I mean, exact same. And I had this revelation recently, and I can't believe it's taken me so many years to reach it, but I think I'm right about this, and you can tell me if you agree that, I do the work that I do because like I genuinely care about people. I care about these issues as social issues, but I care about the individual human beings that they affect. And, often get very like personally invested in, women who reach out to me for help and often try to help. And I think that, me caring about people comes through in my work, as is the case for you. Like when I go through your comments, I often see that like you have responded to like every single comment, and often with substantive, like really warm, caring comments. And I think that's laudable and good. But I also think that the more we do that and the more it becomes apparent how much we care, the more that gets weaponized and the more people expect more care, and they expect you to respond to like what I can only characterize as kind of like passive aggressive tantrums when you don't give them what they want.
Yeah, that's so real. I mean, and sometimes there simply isn't enough time in the day. And I do, like I said, I'm someone who my general thought often morally is that the male standard is wrong. The standard that women have been adhering to is more demanding morally, but is the correct one. So I feel that about kindness and interpersonal warmth. And I'm not someone who feels all that comfortable saying a flat no or just ignoring an email. Like, I really do try to respond. I don't always succeed. But it gets harder when there is this sense of personal obligation, which is both it doesn't scale very well. So people don't always stop to consider that, yes, this might be a relatively small request that only takes me half an hour to look up this set of references for them or get them these files for these various syllabi that they want or whatever it is. But if I'm doing that 10 times a day, it becomes not viable. And then it's not that I think that people shouldn't do that, but the standards they hold me to and you to, and I think that they tend to hold women to in general, is if we don't reach out in that kind of personal way and give people a sense of real connection and real attention and real, like put emotional labor into it, then we're kind of a bitch. And that's just misogyny. Like, again, I wish I had more hours in a day, and I wish that I, in a way, didn't have two full-time jobs in running a Substack and being a professor. But unfortunately, like, that means I have to sometimes prioritize. And I also have a young child and a family, and I occasionally like to have a moment to myself, which doesn't happen very much. But yeah, there is this fear all the time of the, I would say specifically, moralism that attends any woman who asks for too much or is perceived as not giving enough. And I think generally the thing is, we are giving enough and we take the obligation to give back very seriously. Like you, I only do this because I care about people. And if someone is in crisis and they can only reach out to me, I am going to respond to that. And on the other hand, like if someone needs me to essentially photocopy a bunch of materials for them and act as a research assistant, that can be too much to expect from someone who is as strapped for time as I currently am. And I just want to be not punished or hated for effectively having to say no sometimes, or yeah, or for not giving as much as is required, ironically, because I'm relatively well known as someone who has coined distinctions like the idea of women as human givers.
Yeah, it's wild how someone can read all of that work and then approach you in that way. But I see kind of these parallels with this approach to our work and really like any woman's work and how we handle household labor, where we have this idea that what a woman needs is a want. It's her being entitled. So like your need to sleep, to not to eat, to not respond to every email. That's just you being entitled and kind of selfish and kind of bitchy. But everyone else's desire to get a detailed personal response from you, that's a moral obligation. And that's like that moralism that you're talking about, where it's just completely flipped on its head. And it's exactly what we see with household labor of, we're just being bitchy when we complain about men not doing an equitable share. We're being entitled, and this is a privileged woman's problem. When it's the reverse. It's the person who is demanding the labor who's being entitled and awful.
I mean, seriously, I also just think, and this is kind of maybe some people will perceive this connection readily, and for others, it will sound like a stretch. But I'm just going to go out on a limb and say this is one reason why it's so hard in this country to get a female president elected. Because once you have a public figure who is a public figure to absolutely everyone, so unlike someone like me, who is only known to, a tiny niche of people in comparison. Once you have a figure like Elizabeth Warren, for example, she is expected to kind of sustain a personal connection with every potential voter in a way that she ended up kind of evincing in the behavior of taking 100,000 selfies with supporters, which was celebrated and was seen as this wonderful thing. And I agree, it showed her virtues as a person, as a politician. But it also doesn't scale. Like, at what point do you say this is actually not possible or sustainable anymore? And for those people who are disappointed not to have a selfie with Elizabeth Warren, I just hope they know that she hasn't let them down or neglected them or been too highfalutin in what she thought she should prioritize. It is actually just, this is not the right relationship to expect of women, this highly personal attention, when they're really having to do this at a very, very grand scale. And yet, you see this kind of personalization in the way that for a female politician, they're the ones who will inevitably be called by a first name because there's this sense that she's not Clinton, she's Hillary, and she should go on yet another listening tour because she hasn't paid enough attention to individual people in her public, which is by the time you're running for president, is every American voter. And again, it's not to say that those desires don't come from a natural place. I think they're understandable, but I really think that this kind of moralism and this high expectation of women will make it much, much harder for women to be successful public figures with a sense that they cannot attend to everyone in the way that they would attend to a child or a friend or their own family member.
And it is just the collective desire to be tend to be mothered. It's women as, free labor and emoting machines. And I know exactly what you're talking about with Elizabeth Warren too. I remember when, like, all of the selfies started appearing in my Facebook feed, and I had a friend who said something like, "Well, Elizabeth Warren is our collective mom," and I just cringed a little bit. Like, no, like, please, no.
It's the wrong relationship. It's the wrong model. It is fine to be invested in someone's competence and warmth and goodness as a human, but she cannot mother an entire population, as we saw, because the thing about this is research shows this very definitively. I'm thinking here of some really brilliant research by Madeline Heilman and her team at NYU, where if you compare a man and a woman head to head, basically the man is seen as either more competent, or if their competence as a man and woman is clearly on a par, because you include extra information that they're both, top performers or what have you, then he will be seen as more likable, except if you add two pieces of information that kind of break this biased spell. One piece of information that can break the spell is that she's exceptionally communal, warm, giving, super interpersonally kind to everyone on her team, and so on. The other way of breaking that spell of bias is showing that she's not only extremely competent, she's also a mother. And then people suddenly see her as warm and communal in the required way. And so you might say, well, in a way, this is good news. The preference for male over female leaders is not an unbudgeable one. You can get it to shift. But the trouble is, the way you get it to shift is with information that is often simply not there. So Kamala Harris is not a mother, she's a stepmother, if you are invested in that distinction, which I'm not invested in the distinction, but many people on the wrong side of this are, unfortunately. And also, like, why should she have to be any kind of mother in order to be a potentially great president? Now, that also means that someone like Elizabeth Warren, who was seen as very kind, very communal, and happens to be a mother, you might say, well, she's surely a slam dunk. And again, the answer is no, because the idea that women are warm and kind is very fragile. That perception is incredibly fragile, as we see when the second Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have a kind of pretty public beef on stage about some healthcare policy differences. People perceive Elizabeth Warren as actually a bitch in who was kind of pretending all along to be a nice person, that she undermined Bernie Sanders. It's not at all perceived the other way, where he was hostile and aggressive to her and she kind of spoke back to him. But it's not symmetrical in that way at all. So if women need to be incredibly competent and really warm and communal in order to be electable, then they're also subject to this really fragile sense of their communality, which can disappear in an instant the second they have a conflict with anyone, which in a primary is completely inevitable. You are going to have conflicts with your opponents. So that's why I think it's so hard when you look at this research and you reflect on the kind of very personal expectations people have of women, it becomes very hard to have a woman in the public eye survive.
Well, and conflict is inevitable, and particularly when we're talking about the things that actually matter. I think this points a lot to why conflict within feminism is so challenging.
Great
Identifying
point.
these feminists who we think are just wonderful and we love and they've given so much, and then they say something we disagree with, and it feels like a betrayal, and there's just this immediate sort of panic response. And I feel like that's what I see a lot with some readers who the common triggers are sex work, pornography, and beauty culture. Those seem things that readers get, and sometimes weight stuff that readers will get really upset about, where they're likely to disagree with me, and then all of a sudden, like I'm a monster. You talking about this way that we break the bias, you know, I agree with you. Like, yeah, it sounds really nice, but I actually feel like we're just immediately set up for failure, because what is being nice and what is being communal, it's having a personal relationship with people. And so what that means is that there is a limited scale to which any woman can grow. And after that point, she's just a bitch because she can't have a personal relationship with everybody.
I think that's exactly right, unfortunately. There's just a certain scale that you can't grow beyond and be truly loved unless the content of what you do builds in the communality. So you do see like some female public figures, like I think Samin Nosrat is a really great example of this. She's both so interpersonally warm in just her own manner, and her kind of interpersonal style is jokey. And more than anything, she's making yummy food and talking about how to have like a big table and lots of people around it, which I love. I love Samin Nosrat. This is no shade, but it's the only kind of thing a woman can do and survive at the relevant scale. Whereas an Alison Roman, who has like a little bit more of an edge to her, who has said a few things that I agree are not perfect, it's never just like, well, she said a few things that are problematic. It's that she's a bitch and needs to be canceled. And this is where, you know, it bumps up against an issue I think about a lot with cancel culture. Like a lot of people on the left, I think there is a moral panic about cancel culture that is largely misleading. I think that, first of all, people are typically not cancelled. They have comeback tours, you know, thinking of Louis C.K. and Aziz Ansari and so on. But also, sometimes you do cancel a person and you see that socially. Like Neil Gaiman, I think, has been pretty successfully cancelled. And I'm all about that. I wrote saying, yeah, cancel the hell out of this rapist scumbag who I would never buy his book. I would never read his comic or whatever. I know that's painful for some folks who liked him. I never read him myself, but there's really sufficient evidence that he did horrible things to young women that there is no defense of, and he is offered no apology for of a convincing kind. So the other aspect of it, though, is this is all applicable to men, but when it comes to women, I guess I do think that sometimes you see women who, yes, make mistakes, but are public figures who are talented or interesting or have something to offer, effectively canceled, at least in certain sectors, in ways that don't reflect what we should have done. Like, I think this about Lena Dunham, and I'm sure this will be controversial, but I think she's really talented, and I think that when she makes mistakes, it's precisely because of this quality of shamelessness she has that makes her extremely good at exploring heterosexual dynamics in ways that make most women feel deeply ashamed of, like having been rejected or body shamed or just having had male partners who are not sufficient, who are too little, to invert the name of her recent series. But I think that there are many people who have taken certain of her fairly ill-considered remarks completely out of context in ways, again, we don't need to get into all of this, but people interpret things that she wrote about her sister and her, they're very uncomfortable parts of her memoir that talk about her kind of childhood sexual exploration in a way with her sister. But people are calling her a pedophile, which is really inappropriate as a label for a 7-year-old child who is doing, yeah, things that do not strike me as developmentally normal and do strike me as really concerning and harmful. However, I think the idea that we can't consume art from this person who has made her peace with her sibling, Grace, I don't know. I think there's something overblown about that reaction.
There,
Sorry,
I
I
mean,
should have said, has made her peace with her sibling, Cyrus Grace.
okay. I
Sorry.
don't know a lot about Lena Dunham, so I wouldn't have caught that was the wrong sibling name, but I loved your piece about her. It was so great. And the thing that just strikes me with you talking about this is that men are canceled for things like raping people, and even then, they usually get to come back. It's usually their victims who are canceled. Women are canceled for things like not being super nice, saying the wrong thing and then apologizing, once having a bad opinion that they've changed, this sort of stuff. And so the standards are just completely perverted. And the thing that I think about a lot is that so many of these women that we've decided are just monstrous. Like, I'm not even really sure why I'm supposed to hate Lena Dunham, but I know that I'm supposed to hate her. Are, I bet Lena Dunham aligns with me on like 95% of things. And I bet she thinks similarly to me and is probably a nice person, and that we would agree on a lot that matters. But then there are all these men who, people like me love, who I bet would not align with me on much of anything and are probably complete assholes. So we end up canceling people who are much closer to the perfect standard that we demand of women, and allowing men who are just shitbags thrive.
This is an accurate diagnosis, I think. It's what happens when, yes, like it is important to hold people to high standards, but it's also important to let people make mistakes and correct them. And we just have to not have gender double standards. That's actually a really low bar, socially speaking, and I don't think that we always rise to it. And part of the reason that we don't is I've had so many conversations with other women, other feminists who will be like, well, I actually have a lot of time for this or that discredited figure, but I would never say it because I could be canceled as a result of that.
Yes.
And the way that it goes is once a woman has become subject to visceral disgust reactions in a very public way, she is kind of tarnished with the disgust reactions that, as a matter of moral psychology, tend to spread to anything she touches or is adjacent to. So as soon as I defend Lena Dunham and say, look, I actually think it's pretty complicated and I'm not saying everything she's ever done is fine, but I just don't think it rises to the level of I will not consume her art anymore. She's a garbage human. If I say even that level of defense that I think she's a good like social cultural commentator via what she does artistically, that what I am risking is that people become as disgusted with me as they were at Dunham for actually kind of predictable psychological reasons that if you are tangled, if you are caught up with something disgusting, you're seen as tarred with that same brush. And so there is a high risk for anyone who comes to the defense of a problematic woman, especially if she's a woman herself, of then being subject to the same moral disgust reactions as fell the original target. So that's one thing that happens. And the other mechanism that I see happening play out in feminist discourse that is doing a lot of damage here is that we have this unique idea within feminist circles of waves of feminism, which you don't find this metaphor used for any other kind of civil rights movement or liberationist movement. And what the waves metaphor does is build in this idea of obsolescence to thinkers who have come before us. So Catherine MacKinnon is irrelevant. She's a second wave feminist. Like, I'm sorry, what? How did we get there? I beg to differ, and the waves metaphor strikes me as incredibly misleading.
I saw some of that this week on my feed about something I posted where someone was like, well, the second waivers really fucked this up.
Yeah.
And it was on the same day that I interviewed Marlene Gerber Fried, who is, she's still a feminist activist. So I'm not sure we can fairly call her second wave, but she started in the second wave. And I learned so much in a 1 hour conversation from this woman who has 70 years of accumulated activist wisdom. And so then I got off that call and I went to this comment on my Facebook where someone's talking shit about older women. And it felt so personal. Like I was so upset about that. But it's the same dynamic of just dehumanizing women for deviating from whatever standard we want to apply. I want to ask you something about Lena Dunham because I remember when you wrote that piece and I really liked it. And then I made a mental note that I wanted to come back to it later and see what the comments were like. And then I never did. What was the feedback? Did you get people unsubscribing? Were people mad at you? Like, how did that play out for you?
Actually, it was mostly fine. I think my subscribers are a pretty cool and I want to say sophisticated bunch who have sort of familiarized themselves with some of these dynamics and I think are often familiar with the idea that moralism is kind of the enemy of feminist social progress. So I didn't get as much pushback as I was expecting. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure, if I remember rightly, that that is a post that I paywalled for that very reason, because I didn't want it to live on the open internet. I have a feeling if I had written that piece for, I don't know, like a mainstream media outlet, I or just posted it as a free post, my sense is that would probably be subject to more backlash.
Yeah, I have a similar sense, and I do the same thing when I think a post is likely to be controversial and when it's nuanced and people are not going to be comfortable with nuance. So one thing I was thinking of while you were talking about Lena Dunham is, we see women as, we kind of want them to be more human and more humane than men. And then in the process of doing that, we end up dehumanizing them and treating them as these like public products, these like caring machines from whom we get to just, you put the coin in and you get the caring. And so, but then if we think, okay, if we decide to frame, okay, so women are products, like I'm a product and people can buy me, like when they subscribe to my newsletter or whatever, we're still not being fair because the kind of shit that people tolerate from Target, from Amazon, from Walmart is way higher than the sort of stuff that they'll unsubscribe from me for. And it's so interesting that, we'll demand everything from like a small business creator, but would never think of demanding the same from a faceless corporation. So it's just kind of like another example of the more we humanize women, kind of the worse we treat them.
Well, that's why as you know, I tend to think of it not so much as dehumanization and more as vilification, where the woman is turned not exactly into a product, but yeah, a perfect, like a person who should be, in a way, and I don't mean this literally, but morally, she should be superhuman. She should be so good. And she's a villain the second she errs from that standard of perfection. And so, in her very humanness, she's subject to incredibly harsh moral standards and also very instant dismissal in the way you're exactly right about, where, if I buy mittens from Amazon that don't float my boat, I'll give them 3 stars mentally and shrug. Whereas if someone really thinks that I have made a mistake that they think is morally criticizable, I feel like it's kind of, it is a sense that their whole idea of me as a person has to change rather than being a little bit forgiving or having maybe a little toleration that sometimes reasonable minds disagree, even within feminist and progressive circles. And sometimes I might just be wrong, and that's okay too. Like, I think there is a sort of risk aversion that it's very difficult not to have as a feminist writer because you feel like you have to be correct. Otherwise, if you do make a wrong judgment call on something, and if you do say something that disappoints people, it will be dismissal rather than, okay, we differed.
Yeah, this is something I've been sort of practicing because I have found that, as they should, my perspectives have changed over the years. But there's still pieces out there that I wrote that, like, I don't fully agree with anymore.
Sure.
And we're not talking about like radical perspective shifts, like endorsing racism or whatever, but, particularly on marriage, my attitudes have changed. And people like ask me and kind of like come at me. And I'll just say, like, I was wrong before. Like, and people are not prepared to hear that because we treat being wrong as such like a high stakes thing, because I think for women it is.
Yeah, but growth is good actually, and having the capacity to change your mind and revise and update, all of this is good, and it's what requ is required for being a morally responsible practitioner in public discourse. So it is a funny thing, isn't it? It just makes it very difficult too, to say, yeah, I fucked this up. I thought of it this way, and now I'm more persuaded of this other thing. And that's a really good way to stop people from being able to grow publicly in the ways that I think can be really beneficial to witness and model, actually.
So, speaking of being wrong, I have long had like a central disagreement with you that I now no longer disagree with you about. And it's not even that consequential, but you often talk about like women being vilified as uniquely human, whereas I have long written about like the like appliance theory of women. And I don't necessarily think those two things are mutually exclusive, but I do find myself shifting away from that theory and more towards yours. But what I have found when I'm like sitting down to write and thinking about it is I'm like, oh my God, now I have to think about so many other things if like that's not the correct thing. And I'm just like, oh, she's just wrong about that. She just doesn't understand. Because it's like, because I don't want to do the work. Like, I just want to be intellectually lazy sometimes. And I do think that that's what some of this is about, is rather than saying to yourself, like, this person who I respect and like I agree with about so much says this thing that I disagree with, like, could it be that they're right? We're just like, oh, well, she is a woman, so fuck her.
Yeah, I think, the specific disagreement is this one too, where I think we often don't distinguish between disagreements where we think someone on the other side is like flat out wrong in this way, where what they're saying is actively pernicious and we kind of wish the debate would go away, versus so many of the philosophical disagreements that I have, and this is an example of that. They're disagreements where I want to maintain my side of the argument, but I don't necessarily want to win. Like,
Yeah.
I actually think it is valuable to have people in the dehumanization paradigm doing work to illuminate how that plays out and how to understand that with respect to different forms of bigotry and their intersections. And then it's useful to have someone like me who is, in a way, trying to run a pretty extreme form of the line. Like, do we even need to have this dehumanization psychological state that we attribute to people when actually a lot of the work can be done by thinking about social norms and hierarchies together with very ordinary moral emotions like resentment, blame, punishment, and the kinds of things that we actually only do for human beings. So some of the most misogynistic reactions are like highly retributive in a way that barely makes sense for non-human animals, and it certainly doesn't make much sense when it comes to supernatural or subhuman entities. It is just very human to human stuff. And so that's kind of where I go. If I am successful, and this is a big if in my arguments that misogyny doesn't require us to posit dehumanization, that it's much more about moralism, actually, then the question is, if we centered women in our historical explanations, would we need to invoke it elsewhere? Would we need to invoke it when it comes to things like racism and transphobia and fatphobia and so on? Because women are a part of pretty much every oppressed class of person. So examining this intersectionally also has a rather radical implication, which is that if misogyny doesn't involve dehumanizing women, then it would be weird if racism did involve dehumanizing people, because women of color are, of course, subject to both racism and misogyny and their unique intersections, as in misogynoir. So that's kind of the side of the argument that I've wanted to explore, but it doesn't mean there shouldn't be people arguing back that no, this is best understood as thinking of women as more product-like, more animal-like, or something like that. I guess, yeah, I just want to see how far you can get with the idea that being seen as human is not always a good thing for us.
Yeah. Well, and just thinking more broadly about that point of like the importance of having people argue back with our philosophical points. Something that I think a lot about is sex work, pornography, pro-sex, anti-sex, like this whole debate in feminism. And like I'll just tell you that like I am not really sure where I fall in this because I think that there are compelling arguments on all sides of this discussion. And I think that there are often really intense philosophical claims made that don't reflect the real world. So, like, for example, when I was in my 20s, I worked as a paralegal for the corporate office of a strip club. And like at the time was very anti-strip clubs and sort of like went there to like, I guess spy. Like, I just wanted to see what was going on. And my experience there, like, convinced me that, yeah, like, there's rampant exploitation. It's awful. And the men running these clubs are awful. But that also, any legislation that was designed to control these clubs, they didn't affect the men. It only ever affected the women. And so it shifted me from this, like, I know exactly how I feel and I know exactly what needs to happen to this. This is too complicated for me. And I wish that we could like bring those discussions out in a productive way and really grapple with those challenges rather than just as soon as someone says anything about a strip club, like people are hitting the unsubscribe button.
Yeah, that's so real. And I feel similarly about the debate, like, how do we honor people who are sex workers and who are predominantly female, and at the same time, in a non-patronizing way, raise concerns about exploitation and male dominance within those industries? Like, it's a topic I've literally never touched because I think it's very hard to do moral justice to people, who are exploring their best economic option, or who are living in ways that I fully want to respect, and I do respect, but I also worry about. So I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to write in a way that doesn't end up being insensitive to some of the people who deserve to have their lived experience honored.
So I have this like little hateful notebook that I carry around where I write all my ideas in, and most of them never see the light of day. But I started kind of jotting down ideas for a piece on this topic like a year or so ago. And the title that I gave it, and the title is like the only substance I have at this point, was, Is it feminism or is it purity culture? And, you know, because like I really feel like this is about moral purity. And on, you know, the pro-sex work, pro-sex side, it's about, you know, standing up for sex workers and standing up against, you know, like Puritanism and all of that. And then on the anti-sex work side, it's standing up for women and against violence and all of that. And both sides think they have the moral high ground and are willing to concede nothing. And it's just this like moral purity debate.
Yeah, that seems exactly right to me. And I do think that probably no one wins as a result of someone like me being silent in this way about it. And no one really wins if I had a kind of contribution to what ends up being a debate that feels very monolithic. I wonder. One of the things that this conversation is making me realize is that the moralism to which women in public life are subject to is really the enemy of nuance, because a lot of these difficult questions call for a lot of sensitivity, a lot of nuance, and a lot of attentiveness. And it's also unlikely that you'll be able to come up with a line that just satisfies everyone that you've done your moral duty as a commentator. As a result of that kind of, that nuance that we're both reflecting here, a felt need for.
Well, and I think that silence is the goal, and that sort of loops back around to the initial insight that made me want to talk about this with you, which is that when you can't have nuance and when you can't just kind of put questions out into the ether of, hey, I'm thinking about this, but I don't have a firm opinion, it silences meaningful discussion. And it most importantly silences meaningful discussion from women who might have something to contribute, and this is just like misogyny policing us.
That is exactly how I feel sometimes, where if I have an idea in progress, I've been noodling on this idea for a very long time on how shame is not the enemy, and that just because a lot of shame is corrosive doesn't mean that every instance of moderate shame needs to be jettisoned. But it's taken me months, arguably years, to begin to write about this because I just felt so much pressure to get it right the first time.
Yeah, I've really liked you can you had a piece like 2 days ago on shame, and I was just so glad you wrote about it. And like what I was thinking when I read it, and like I hope you don't take this the wrong way, is I was thinking like this is like a first attempt and I can't wait to see like what comes next. It was like so good, but I just like knew that there was like more underneath it.
Yeah, it's funny because the day before that, I had written like 5,000 words in order to write 1,500 words, trying to just work through why philosophically the idea of a shame-free approach to parenting or politics, it doesn't really work. Like, it doesn't work to just feel guilt and never reflect that. Yes, you end up because of some of your deeds and behaviors being such and such a person in relation to other people. And the idea that you can never catch a glimpse of yourself, not really like what you see, feel a moment of shame, and then move on from there to be like, okay, how do I get back into relation with the people I want to be in relationship with? I think that's something that I want to write a more general piece about, but it is really hard because so many people have found shame to be so immobilizing and so much a part of everything from purity culture to certain religious cultures to certain kinds of morality cultures that I get why people are sometimes really, really allergic to shame. And I certainly don't think we should be shaming our children. I think that is not defensible and not productive. But I also, yeah, I there is a lot more in there. You're right that I hope to get to about the pang of shame that can be morally productive without being corrosive or eviscerating of someone as a person.
I feel like we need a term for this shame allergy. So I'm going to call it weaponized anti-shame, which is just like the worst term ever, but it's the one that popped into my head.
No, it seems
So,
accurate.
like, one area where I see this constantly is in heterosexual relationships and probably like employment relationships with men too, but mostly women's relationships with their male romantic partners, where she comes to him and she's like, yo, I'm doing 10 hours a day of childcare and you're doing an hour a day and that's shitty. So like, please stop. And what does he say? Well, I guess I'm just a terrible person and I should just kill myself then. And like, then she has to comfort him. And that's like exactly like, dude, maybe you should feel ashamed of that. And maybe that should be telling you that you should change.
Yeah, exactly. And if we had a culture where people could say, okay, there is something that's being revealed about myself that isn't great. And that doesn't mean I'm a terrible person to my core or that I have no worth or that I don't deserve connection. It means I have to change something about not just my behavior, but maybe myself more broadly, more deeply. I have to have somewhat different thoughts and dispositions and ways of deliberating and reasoning. Like I have to think actively about how much unpaid household and child-rearing labor I'm doing every day. I think that that would be really good. And I think something similar culturally when it comes to the people who look at our broad culture and say, well, shaming Trump voters hasn't worked, so what do? We have to move on without shame. It's like, well, no, not really. An alternative is that we all have to be more resilient in the face of mild shame that can be the morally appropriate reaction to it being revealed that you have done huge amounts of harm that, yes, you should feel bad about and guilty about the deed, but you also have been revealed to be someone in relation to others. That is an occasion for shame. And that is not something that should be fled from or shied away from or avoided. And it's also not without redemptive possibilities. So I feel like there is a moderate way of thinking about shame that we have just sort of abandoned as a culture. Like between Ezra Klein and Dr. Becky and Brené Brown, the easy line on this is, well, feel no shame and just like think about what you did and do it differently. But that can't be right because what we did often reveals something about who we are. And also, if you do the same things repeatedly, then yes, that does mean that certain things about you as a character are true. If you keep lying, then eventually at some point it's true that you're a liar. But that also doesn't make you beyond the pale and irredeemable. It means you have to like do some serious work
Well,
to
and I
be more
think
honest.
like a culture of actual, true, meaningful redemption, like a restorative justice culture, should be the goal where people can say, like, yeah, I thought and did some really shitty things, and now I'm gonna fix it, rather than like, what I see in every like white anti-racist space of like, how very dare you? I am an ally to my core, and no one is sadder about racism than I am. Like, wouldn't it just be a much better response to be like, hey, I'm going to sit with that? Like, maybe you're right.
That is exactly it.
Well, okay. So you and I could talk to you about this forever, but I want you to
Same.
please write more about shame. Like, can I put in a request? There's so much.
I would love to do that. I need to be emboldened. Thank you, Zon, because I think I shall. And yeah, it's a tricky topic.
Yeah, it is, but I think you're prepared to cover it. So, all right. Well, I'm gonna leave it here. Thank you so much, Kate, for coming on. I hope this has given people some things to think about how we deal with public figures and with each other, and maybe how we could potentially get to a world where we could like talk about sex work at some point.
Yeah, I love that.
Like that would be great. I would love that. So I'm just so grateful to have you on the show and grateful for your presence in the world, Kate. You're just the best.
Likewise, Zahn. So grateful to be in conversation with you and for your amazing work.
All right, well, thank you.